can renormalize in this expansion, and in fact it does, and this has been explicitly checked and shown that this anomalous dimension appears at three loop order in the same diagrams that we saw it appear before. But now it's suppressed by 1 over n squared, so one has explicit control over the calculation.
Wait, what's x?
X is some function of this parameter epsilon n that you're keeping fixed.
Well, how does it behave? Is it analytic in its argument or not?
So at large, n and beta go as at large argument, beta go as the square of the argument.
So have a small argument.
David?
I don't remember.
I'm not sure if you can carefully check. So that's related again to this question of what happens when alpha becomes small, right?
Isn't that where it's controlled?
So the expansion is controlled. The second expansion, you're fixing this. The fixed point coupling is of order 1. You're fixing this epsilon n to be of order 1. The control comes from the additional 1 over n squared that appears in front. So it's just like ordinary 1 over n expansion, except there is some fixed point coupling which is of order 1. So in particular, actually, from this you can see why if you just fix epsilon and let n go to infinity, the large n expansion fails, because this fixed point value of the coupling constant becomes of order n. So that's the reason that the standard 1 over n expansion fails, and why you need to do this double expansion. Yeah, we should check what happens at small.
It better be sick in some way, because otherwise, I mean, if it's analytic in epsilon, and I mean, if x is analytic in its argument, we could just set n equals 1.
Yeah, so then
data f just has an epsilon.
Then you would just say that this perturbative expansion, perturbative-like expansion works, and I haven't said that it doesn't. That it doesn't work. I just said that it needs to be checked. So this was pretty technical, and I apologize for that. But now let me just at least based on this 1 over n expansion, we can calculate some quantities. The things that we can calculate best are just the propagator of the are the correlation functions of the gauge field and the correlation functions of the spin-off. But you know, the correlation function, the Green function of the spin-on, we cannot directly measure, because that's not a gauge invariant quantity. So that's not terribly useful in some sense. And the gauge propagator also measuring directly is challenging. So really, we would like to calculate physical quantities, and those are actually much more difficult to calculate. But for the specific heat, we can at least. I think fairly confidently we can say that it's just going to behave as t to the 2 over z, where z is the dynamical critical exponent, and at least if z remains unrenormalized from its value of 3, then this is t to the 2 over specific heat. Experimentally, for this compound DMIT, it's claimed that the specific heat grows linearly with temperature, but as Sentel already has discussed in his talk, there's a lot of uncertainty, and one can probably fit the result with t to the 2/3 as well. Next, let me talk about the uniform spin susceptibility. So it turns out that in order to calculate this quantity, we need in my opinion, a systematic theory of the forward scattering channel in this problem. In the same way that in ordinary Landau thermoliquid theory, we have a forward scattering channel of the Landau parameters in the forward scattering channel. I don't think such a theory has been worked out to date, and I'll say a few words about this in the rest of my talk. At present, the theoretical result says that the spin susceptibility is constant at low temperatures, just as in a Fermi liquid, and that's what's observed for DMIT. Next, we have transport properties, and these are probably things which are hardest to calculate, but at least, so the currently accepted result is that the thermal conductivity goes as T to the 1/3 in the interaction-dominated regime, but is cut off by impurities such that it goes kappa over T of the constant in the impurity-dominated regime. That's indeed what's observed. Well, that's the result of an ordinary thermoliquid theory, and that's also what's observed in the MIT. Let me mention one theoretical issue, and that has been already raised. That's the issue of using the gauge field fluctuations as if it was non-compact. As already discussed at some length, the gauge field in this problem is compact, so there are these monopole or instanton events in space-time present. And we know that these instanton effects are potentially very dangerous when there is no spin on Fermi surface. When the matter fills a gap, these instanton effects lead to confinement, and one doesn't get any interesting exotic spin liquid state. So at the present moment, it's believed that in this problem, instanton effects are irrelevant. That is, the instantons themselves are not in the plasma phase, but are confined. So they only appear in tightly bound pairs, and essentially do not change the structure of the vacuum. And that's based on RPA calculations performed a long while back by Yoff and Larkin, but also on more systematic calculations by Sang-Sik-Lee.
Yes? Does that require a large N at all? Or not?
That actually, I don't think that requires a large N. So the argument there is the very, very basic, the very zeroth order argument, because we know that if we had a theory with Dirac particles instead of a Fermi surface, then the scaling dimension of the monopole operator goes to the number of the Dirac cones. However, in particular, the number of cones is large, the operator is irrelevant. However, here we have a whole Fermi surface, so that's like infinitely many cones. So one might hope that these monopoles actually have infinite scaling dimension as they are confined. That's in fact what both of these calculations give. There are some issues with, generally, there are some issues with this argument. For instance, we know that when n is large for this problem, we can do all the calculations exactly. However, in the spin on Fermi surface problem, you might think that, okay, it's like infinitely many Dirac cones, you don't even need large N to control anything. However, that turns out not to be the case due to this very special kinematics connecting the opposite patches of the Fermi surface. In fact, for many of the properties, really the fact that you have many, many patches is not important. But I think for this instanton properties, this kind of naive argument works. Okay. So let me now shift gears a little bit from this very technical discussion and talk about perhaps a more physical question, of pairing, possible pairing instabilities of the spin on Fermi surface state and transition to a pair Z2 spin liquid. And this is some work in progress. Let me acknowledge my collaborators, Sibir Sajdev at Harvard, Sentil at MIT, and David, who's in the audience. Okay, so we know that a regular Fermi liquid is unstable to an arbitrarily weak attraction in the BCS channel, which drives superconductivity. And the question is, what is the corresponding statement for the spin-on Fermi surface? And it turns out that if you just subject the spin-on Fermi surface, we don't expect it to be immediately unstable to pairing of spin-ons, to BCS pairing of spin-ons. And the reason for that is that the fluctuations of the gauge field mediate a long-range repulsion in the BCS channel. So remember that the electric field is gapped in this problem. So it's only the magnetic fluctuations which are gapless. And magnetic fluctuations mediate current-current interactions. Now, if you look at pairing in BCS channel, that involves spin-ons on opposite sides of the Fermi surface. Those spin-ons will therefore carry opposite currents, and opposite currents repel, right, and Pierre's law. So magnetic fluctuations, magnetic field fluctuations lead to a long-range repulsion in the BCS channel, which means that essentially, in Landau Fermi liquid theory terms, all the amplitudes of the BCS function V in all angular momentum channels are equal to positive infinity. So in this case, we don't really expect the gauge fluctuations by themselves to lead to pairing instability of the Fermi surface. However, in general, in addition to the long-range gauge fluctuations, there will also be some short-range for Fermi interactions between the spin-ons present. And in principle, we can imagine that if we make the short-range interaction between the spin-ons sufficiently attractive in the BCS channel, then it will eventually force the spin-ons into a paired state.
Are you looking only at the S-wave
pairing? Actually, my analysis will include all pairing channels.
Those be kind of repulsive interaction through BTU pairing, right? You look at other channels.
Okay, so the point is the following, that just let's talk about ordinary Fermi liquid theory. So when we say that in Fermi liquid theory, that for ordinary metals, let's say small u Hubbard model, that a repulsive interaction can give us a pairing in higher angle momentum channels, what we really mean is that we start with some Fermi surface, and on the lattice scale, you only have a repulsive interaction U in the S-wave channel, so V, in Landau theory terms, V at L equals 0 is equal to plus U. But then, really to talk about Landau theory, Landau Fermi liquid theory, we have to integrate down to a small shell of states around the Fermi surface. And in the process of that integration down to a small set of thin shell, we generate V, we generate interactions in other angular momentum channels which are attractive. And there is actually a very nice detailed analysis by Srinivas Raghu and Steve Kivelson of exactly, systematically how this happens. Right, so whenever I talk about these Landau parameters, so BCS parameters, I imagine that I have already integrated down to a thin shell of states around the Fermi surface. And in fact, we will see that in this problem, there is very little distinction between various angular momentum channels. Okay, so then we imagine that we can put in this short-range attractive interaction between the spin-ons, and eventually it drives a pairing. And then we can ask, what is the critical strength of interaction, of attractive interaction needed? In ordinary probabilistic theory, the critical value is zero. What about here? Okay, before we discuss what that critical value is, let me just discuss the possible phase diagram. So if sufficiently attractive interaction can drive pairing, we can end up with the following phase diagram, where as long as the short-range interaction is sufficiently repulsive, I have a stable spin-on Fermi surface state where the spin-ons are not paired up. So this state is the state that I've been discussing up till now. It has gapless spin-on excitations, F alpha near the Fermi surface, and it has the gapless BH field fluctuations. Now, once interaction becomes sufficiently attractive, the spin-ons pair up. And here I have not specified exactly in what spin channel or angular momentum channel they pair up. And that's not terribly important, but, as we'll see. But generally, once this happens, just as in an ordinary superconductor, the spin-ons, the fermions become gapped. There are gapped Bogoliubov quasi-particles. In addition, the gauge fluctuations also become gapped via the Higgs-Wanderson-Higgs mechanism. So there is no longer a gapless gauge field. And instead of that, we have the gauge field penetrating the superconducting state in the form of Abrakosov vortices, which in this gauge theory context are known as Y zones. So then this paired state is nothing but a familiar Z2 spin movement. Okay, so this kind of phase diagram, I think, is fairly believable. The question is, the theoretical question is whether the transition between these two phases can be second order. And previously, it has been believed that the transition is always driven first order by gauge fluctuations. And I will argue that that need not be the case, and that in fact a stable fixed point can exist so that this transition can be second order.
So Max, you mentioned to me, may I remember correctly, but if you replace a short-range attraction with a gauge attraction, so that the spin-ons are the opposite gauge charge, then it's always unstable?
Yeah, then it's always unstable. So that's in fact the case of, that also is the case of phase transitions in metals, where order parameter fluctuations typically mediate attraction in the BCS channel. So that's also always unstable to pairing.
So is the difference between this and the usual superconducting transition like methods? The only difference is that here it's in two dimensions, and the gauge field is a two-dynamical electron and dynamic gauge field. Because you would say, there are also arguments back in the 70s that the usual transition is gapped out, is driven first order by gauge field.
Okay, so there are several questions. There's First point is about the thermal. The things in the 70s is about the thermal phase transition, and that there. Okay, so the question is whether you treat the external gauge field as a dynamical gauge field, or as a or whether you treat the physical electromagnetic field as a dynamical gauge field or not. And for many purposes, one should not really treat it as a dynamical field, or at least on short enough length scales. So I don't think
Yeah, let's discuss zero temperature transition, actually. Zero in the three-dimensional method from a superconductor to an insulator.
Yeah.
And that is not thought to be driven first order, or is it?
Okay, so first is the question of whether we are taking gauge fluctuations.
Yeah, let's take it.
But then you have to take them into account in the metal as well, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
But no one has ever seen current-current interactions, at least to my knowledge, current-current interactions in the metal giving rise to non-permi liquid T log T specific heat.
Right. So alpha is so small, and alpha is very small, so it's very hard to see.
Exactly, but that's exactly the point, that if you're taking those, if you're taking the gauge T fluctuations into account, then you're assuming that alpha, that you can see this effect.
But on the theoretical level, in three dimensions, it will, because there are only logarithmic corrections, it will not happen, and it's more dangerous that these fluctuations will.
They're irrelevant in three dimensions.
They're marginally irrelevant.
It's
marginal, yes.
In fact, I believe that in three dimensions, the story that you'll have. It's very similar to the story that I'm going to describe here with epsilon equal to zero. So if you treat the physical gauge field as fully fluctuating gauge field, then the story will be very similar to what I have to say here in the case when epsilon is zero.
Why shouldn't we do that?
Sorry?
You say we shouldn't do that. Why shouldn't we do that?
Well, just for practical purposes, right? No one has really ever seen.
Just because alpha is small.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But in principle, it's the same problem.
Right, but I mean, before you talk about the transition there, you would want to see some, at least if you want to apply it to real world, you first have to see some evidence of non-permi liquid behavior already in the metal, really.
So the key-type honeycomb spin liquid is Z2, but with the gapless fermions.
Yeah.
Where does that fit into this picture?
Yeah, so in fact, I haven't specified the pairing symmetry here. So it's possible that, you know, this pairing has some kind of D-wave channel, so that there are nodes around. And in fact, that will not be the precise structure of the gap in the ordered phase, or in the Z2 spin liquid phase, will not be important for the properties of the transition. In fact, we'll see that the universality of the transition in all angular momentum channels is essentially the same.
So it's okay even if you have gapless spinners?
Yeah.
Even with the Fermi surface?
Yeah. Even if you have Dirac.
That has Dirac nodes. If you have larger, like a whole density of states of gapless modes. Is that a problem? I mean, is that impossible?
You mean that you pair in such a way that you still are left with a Fermi surface at the end?
With more than just a few points of gapless modes.
Yeah, I haven't really thought about this. I would imagine. Well, in fact, in this scenario, I think when you pair k and minus k points, it's generally very hard to end up with the whole Fermi surface at the end. I'll come back to this point in one slide. Any other questions about it?
Yeah. If you're so spin on Fermi surface, if I have a Jabrik spin liquid with U1, that problem must be understood by now. I don't know. Is it already known everything about that? If it's a Jabrik spin liquid with U1 gauge field,
yes.
To BCS.
Okay, so if it's an algebraic spin liquid, right, and in the large and limited stable, and
yeah,
all the quartic interactions, all the Fermi interactions have are irrelevant. So then you are asking the question of, as you tune the coefficient of that.
At finite coupling, is it some non-permi?
So that's some kind of like a gross Neveu model, but with great gauge fluctuations.
Right.
Yeah, I do not really know the fate of that. I don't know if anybody has any comment. Presumably, but it's a simple problem because it's just a relative.
Maybe it's not.
Now, I should say that there is another kind of pairing instability that has been proposed by these authors, which goes under the name of Ampérian pairing. So just turning the argument around that currents on opposite sides of the Fermi surface are opposite, so they repel, one can note that if I take two spinons on the same side of the Fermi surface, they have currents pointing in the same direction, and so they attract. So one may imagine that even without adding any additional four Fermi spinon interaction, the system might be maybe sympathetic to a Larkin-Ovchinnikov full deferral type pairing where you pair up the spinons on the same side of the Fermi surface. So I'm not going to discuss this possibility, and in particular, in the limit when I'm going to be able to do my calculations, when this parameter epsilon is much smaller than one, the system is far from this instability. And the reason for that is that when epsilon is equal to zero, the system is a kind of a marginal Fermi liquid. So it's almost Fermi liquid. And in the Fermi liquid, the system, Fermi liquid is very far from this instability because essentially just for phase space reasons, these interactions, four Fermi interactions involving spinons on the same, or fermions on the same side of the Fermi surface are irrelevant.
But it's a very singular interaction.
Right. So, but so for epsilon small, it's not singular enough. I can make no statement about the case when epsilon is equal to one, and there it's perhaps true that there is the instability. Okay. Right. So let's come back to this PCS pairing. Turns out that to analyze the stability, the analysis of stability or instability of the spinon Fermi surface with respect to BCS pairing is poses new theoretical challenges. And the reason is the following: just to see where the challenges are coming from. So let's look at the BCS scattering amplitude of spinons on opposite sides of the Fermi surface. So in this, so let me work on this two-patch theory, and I'm also going to use small epsilon to control my calculations. So let me look at the BCS scattering amplitude of spinons in opposite patches mediated by gauge fluctuations. And then let me look at how those that amplitude gets renormalized by further gauge fluctuations. It turns out that this diagram, this correction diagram, this one loop correction, is enhanced by the following factor. So let's look at the argument of the logarithm here. So the way that I've been doing scaling up to now, I've been so omega is just the kind of the typical energy in the problem, and qy is the momentum exchange carried by this gauge fluctuation, or in other words, the angle by which the pair scatters. So the way I've been doing scaling up till now, I've been scaling the size of the patches, so I've been scaling qy and the energy omega in such a way that the argument of this logarithm is of order 1. And this, in that case, this logarithm is completely innocent, and I have a small prefactor in front of it. However, there is a different regime that one can imagine, where one keeps the angle by which the Cooper pair scatters fixed, that is, one fixes qy, and one lets the energy go to zero. And in this regime, the argument of the logarithm is large, so this correction is large. And there's two ways of doing scaling. The first one is just the scaling that I've been using, the scaling of the two-mesh theory, and the other is the scaling that's used in ordinary Fermi liquid theory, where only the direction of momentum perpendicular to the Fermi surface scale. So the fact that you have these two regimes, I believe, is not unrelated to the fact that if I write down a quartic interaction of the spinons, this quartic interaction is irrelevant in the two-patch theory. That's the reason that haven't been writing this interaction up to this point. But this interaction is marginal in ordinary Fermi-liquid theory. So there is some conflict here. And this conflict is reflected directly in the calculations. Okay, but let me ignore that problem for now, and let me just put in a BCS type for Fermi interaction linking the two opposite patches of the Fermi surface, and let me study how that for Fermi interaction gets renormalized by gauge fluctuations, just at one loop order. And what I find is that there is that the correction has this log squared behavior. So anyone who has done renormalization, so I probably need like 5 minutes to finish. Almost there. So anybody who has done a renormalization group calculations knows that if one is getting log squares, one is in deep trouble. So what these singularities are typically indicating is that you're not doing RG in the right way. You're integrating out some gapless excitations. And it's clear what we are doing wrong here. So we start with these two patches, right? And then in each RG step, we are trying to shrink the width of the patch. So to shrink the width of the patch, we need to integrate out the gapless. We need to integrate out the spin-on excitations in the shaded area. But some of those excitations live directly on the Fermi surface, so are gapless and cannot be integrated out. So that's where this problem is coming from. So in a sense, to treat this problem, we need to somehow combine the two scaling approaches, the two patch scaling, which describe all the non-Fermi liquid properties of my state, with an ordinary Shankar type scaling, where one only scales momentum perpendicular to the Fermi surface. Okay, and there is actually a way towards a marriage of these two approaches, which has been suggested by Damson in the context of pairing in dense quark matter. So their pairing takes place by a color gauge field in a very similar way to the present problem. So the idea is that we are still going to shrink the size of the patches in each step, but what we are going to do is we are not going to integrate gapless spin-ons out, but we are going to divide in each RG step, we are going to divide the patches into smaller patches, and we are going to keep the couplings between the smaller patches, and we are going to monitor how those couplings flow on the RG. Okay, so what kind of... So in addition to intra-patch couplings, we are now also keeping inter-patch couplings. So what kind of couplings should I keep? Well, that's just dictated by kinematics, and we know this already from ordinary Fermi-liquid theory, that there are two types of couplings which survive the kinematics of the Fermi surface. And those are forward scattering couplings and BCS scattering couplings. So for now, let me ignore the forward scattering because I'm focusing on the bearing channel. Keep only this BCS couplings. Now I know that in ordinary Fermi-liquid theory, these BCS couplings flow in the following way. So the couplings in various angular momentum channels, Vm, flow like this. And this gives me the standard result that arbitrary small attraction leads to pairing. So I would like to ask, in which way is this flow equation of the pairing amplitudes modified by the presence of this gapless gauge field fluctuation? Okay, so to answer this question, let me start with my two patches, and let me perform an RG step where I divide them into further patches.
Just one short question. you're only looking at nearby patches, because for DCS instability, that can occur between very far away patches.
I'm going to keep coupling between all patches here in this V. It's fine to keep coupling between all patches. Okay, so the question is, so now I perform this RG step of dividing large patches into smaller patches. So what happens in the process? Well, in the large patch theory, I could have a graph like this, where there is some gauge field fluctuation mediating interaction in the BCS channel between the spin-ons. However, in the RG step, I'm integrating out the gauge fluctuations in this range of momenta. So what used to be inter-patch, what used to be intra-patch, non-local interaction mediated by the gauge field becomes an inter-patch, local interaction that can now be absorbed into this BCS parameter V coupling now with two different patches. And this kind of, so this happens at each renormalization group step, and it generates the following renormalization group flow of the DCS amplitudes V. So now I just combine this extra piece generated by the presence of the gauge field with the ordinary Fermi-liquid flow equation of the DCS amplitudes. And I further combine that with the flow equation for my intra-patch coupling constant alpha, for my fine structure constant. And I just go and I solve these two coupled equations together. And that's very easy. And so we already learned that the fine structure constant flows to a infrared stable fixed point like this. So I can just plug this infrared stable, this fixed point coupling into the flow equation of the BCS amplitude, and I get the following flow. So in this flow, there are two perturbatively accessible stable fixed point. There are two perturbatively accessible infrared fixed points. One occurs at a positive value of V, of the Fermi interaction, and that is an infrared stable fixed point, and it corresponds to the stable spin-on Fermi surface state. So the presence of this stable fixed point indicates that the spin-on Fermi surface is stable against small values of the Fermi BCS interaction, either attractive or repulsive. However, if I make the attraction sufficiently strong, I reach this second fixed point, which is an infrared unstable fixed point. It occurs at a finite negative value of the short-range interaction. So this fixed point I interpret as the fixed point controlling the transition from the spin-on Fermi surface state to a paired state. Because once I cross this fixed point, the value of V runs away to negative infinity, which one can interpret as the instability towards pairing.
On the conductor, and I just don't understand how these can happen, because the gauge field fluctuations are only relevant in a very narrow patch, right?
Yes.
So basically, I can imagine already integrating down to this very narrow patch, and then you're saying further, and then this adds some positive interaction that competes with BCS. But actually, I can put the BCS interaction. The BCS interaction is between very very distant patches that have. Already, the gauge field fluctuations are no longer relevant between them,
yes,
because they're
true.
So distant.
True.
And these fermions will pair, and they'll be uninhibited by, this pairing will not be inhibited by gauge field fluctuation, right?
Absolutely. So that pairing you can put in as an initial value of So let me answer your question in more detail. All right. Let's imagine that we begin with a Fermi surface like this, with some kind of shell of states of thickness lambda around it. Okay. So now you're saying that I'm only going to keep the gauge fluctuations with momentum smaller than, let's say, square root of lambda in this case. Okay? So then you're saying that there are also
BCS terms.
With angular scattering larger than square root of lambda. And that's fine. So they're incorporated in this VM. But the point is that I start this, that on energy scales larger than lambda, I have this flow equation. Just an ordinary Fermi liquid flow equation, right? So if the starting point of VM was sufficiently negative that by the point that I reach the cutoff lambda, things already paired up, then all bets are off. Okay, it's paired up. But if it wasn't, if the starting point of V was not attractive enough, and that energy scale lambda Vm still hasn't diverged to negative infinity, I now just start. So now the gauge fluctuations become effective, and I just continue with this flow equation, with the starting point of Vm at energy equal to lambda. So those, in that sense, those large values of angular scattering are kept here. They're just kept as initial values of Vm. And in particular, the question of which channel the pairing occurs in is controlled by the starting value of V. I could drive transition in either channel. Sorry, almost done. And now I can, so the existence of this infrared fixed point tells me that there is a second order transition between the spin on Fermi surface phase and the Z2 spin liquid. At least that such transition is possible. And I can calculate how the spin on gap onsets across this transition, and there is some just nice power law behavior with exponents that we can calculate in this epsilon expansion. I should say that all the results, all the renormalization group results, in the limit when epsilon is small, can be exactly reproduced by Eliasberg type calculations. So that makes one trust the RG a little bit more, or the Eliasberg a little bit more. Once we know that this space diagram is there, there are some interesting questions about the nature of this paired state, of the Z2 spin liquid state near the transition. So, as I said, this state is quite similar to, one can think of it as a kind of a superconductor. Then we know that there are type 1 and type 2 superconductors. So it turns out that this superconductor is probably in the type 1 regime. So that has implication for the stability of an kind of a lattice of bisons that one could imagine inducing by applying an external magnetic field and taking advantage of this coupling introduced by Alexei Matrunich. And it also has consequences for the hierarchy of energy scales. So the gap that I discussed on the previous slide, this gap that onsets across the phase transition, that's the gap for the spin-on excitations. But there is also going to be a gap for the bisons, which is, you know, in the superconducting language, the energy of the vortex. And it's an open question how that onsets across the transition. Most likely it's much larger than this spin-on gap, but we don't really know the exact location. Okay, so sorry for running over the time. So this is just my conclusions that so in the last few years, we gained some understanding of the spin-on Fermi surface state and its relatives, but there is still lots of work to be done. And so I presented the first theory of the pairing transition out of the spin-on Fermi surface state. Thank you.